My name is Michael McCusker. As you probably know, Tuesday, uno di octo, was the fiscal new year, if any fiscality remains. It was not quite the day the world ends, but shutting down the U.S. government might seem to be an equivalent to many hundreds of thousands of Americans, including neighbors and friends. The fact that it is absolutely unnecessary and ultimately self-destructing to the nation as a whole defies intelligence, no matter which side of the increasing partisan divide anyone or everyone might claim to be on. So much bile and misery, self-inflicted and self-delusional. Or so I think, at any rate. And that's my editorial rant for the morning. I would now like to read an article that appeared in the Oregon Quarterly, the magazine of the University of Oregon, autumn 2013. It's called The Stand She Took by Elizabeth Kramer. How an Emerald editor's gutsy decision to protect her sources frustrated authorities, rallied journalists, and helped change the law. Annette Buchanan lies in bed, shaking and fighting back tears. Yesterday, the 20-year-old was subpoenaed. Buchanan, the Oregon Daily Emerald's managing editor for just 4 weeks, was at work when she learned that she and three Emerald co-workers must appear in court on June 3, 1966. The district attorney has questions about Buchanan's recent article, Students Condone Marijuana Use. And, of course, if you're not U of O graduates or attendees, the Emerald is the University of Oregon's newspaper. The next morning, Buchanan, likely sleepy from a restless night, slips on a high-necked blue dress. Usually her long brown hair flies free. Today she pulls it back into a tight ponytail, her mother's suggestion to get the right image across. The third floor of the Lane County Courthouse is crowded with journalists when Buchanan appears shortly before 10 a.m. Her lawyer, Arthur Johnson, escorts her to the doors of the grand jury room. He can go no further. Protocol forbids him from accompanying his client inside, leaving Buchanan to enter alone, the door swinging shut behind her. Buchanan is a University of Oregon junior majoring in journalism. At the Emerald, she makes $65 a month with the promise of a $20 raise come fall. Her horoscope in the day's newspaper, situations may put you in conflict with those that enforce the laws. Arguments will get you nowhere. Be amiable and discreet. I don't think the grand jury has to ask me to reveal my news sources, and I don't think they have the right to force me, Buchanan says under oath on June 3rd. Do you think the grand jury should be interested in apparent law violations on the campus involving drugs? Asks William Fry, the Lane County District Attorney, known for his youthful ambition, pipe smoking, and impeccably tailored suits. A week ago, on May 22nd, two disgruntled students approached Buchanan in the student union. They were unhappy with the Emerald's coverage of a public lecture by Sidney Cohen, a leading LSD authority who had spoken on campus about drugs and drug use. This was 1966, and yes, this was infamously freewheeling Eugene. But Timothy Leary's iconic turn on, tune in, drop out speech was still a year away, and recreational drug use remained a fringe activity. The students had accused the Emerald of being anti-marijuana, Buchanan recalled, and unwilling to print the other side of the story. She knew the charges were false, but was eager to address even misguided perceptions of bias. So she came up with a simple idea that would change her life: interview pot smokers and tell their story. And with her editor's approval, that's precisely what she did. That same night, Buchanan spent 2 hours interviewing seven students who use marijuana. They advocated the pleasurable sensation of pot and shared their favorite ways to use it, eat it like in spaghetti sauce. It was late when they dropped Buchanan off outside her Alder Street apartment. There, she stayed up half the night writing before destroying her notes. "You know what pot laws are?" asked D.A. Fry, who atypically handled Buchanan's case rather than pass it on to his assistant. "Yes," Buchanan replies. "You think they're valid?" "I don't think this applies at all." "Applies for what?" "I see no reason for that question." "It is not up to you to determine the reason for the question. You just answer the question." "Well, I am not going to." That, of course, was the problem. Fry wanted answers. It's why he subpoenaed Buchanan, her editor Phil Samus, former editor Charles Beggs, and former managing editor Bob Carl. After reading Buchanan's article on the front page of the May 24th Emerald. The same day Fry issued the subpoenas, he took the unusual step of releasing a press statement including a photo of him holding the offending emerald. In the release, he explained, "As long as federal and state drug regulations are on the books, the sellers and the users can expect to be prosecuted if we get the evidence." And evidence was precisely what he wanted from the four students he called to the courthouse. Samus, Beggs, and Carl were dismissed within hours of their testimony. They had little to do with the story and didn't know the sources. Buchanan, however, said she remembered at least five names, names she would not be giving to the police. In the canons of ethics, a newsman, a reporter, will not release his sources when they were given to him confidentially, she tells the jury. This is an understood precept of journalism. Understood, perhaps, but not legally protected. In 1966, exempting a reporter from answering questions posed by a legal official was a far cry from the protections enjoyed by today's journalists. Only 12 states offered so-called shield or privilege laws, allowing journalists some level of security to keep their sources confidential. Oregon wasn't one of them. "I don't know if you should need a grand jury to find out about drug use on campus," Buchanan continues in her testimony. "You can properly investigate and do it through the normal channels." "Do you have any suggestions?" Fry asks. "Go on campus. Sit around and look. It's not that hard. I think you know." She also suggests her inquisitor has previously used subpoenas to get people to cooperate with the city police. "Apparently," Fry replies, "people who have been subpoenaed won't speak, so we haven't lost much." Buchanan's resolute silence, it seems, stymies the legal system. After just 7 minutes, the grand jury concludes. Afterwards, Fry, Buchanan's lawyer, and Circuit Court Judge Edward Levy settle on a June 13th hearing, which results in a court order officially requesting Buchanan answer Fry's questions on June 15th. "I'm sorry," she says that day in front of the grand jury, once again reaffirming her commitment to keep her sources secret. "It's a confidence that I cannot violate for the reasons that I gave." With that, Annette Buchanan is charged with contempt of court. Her trial is scheduled for June 27th. If convicted, she faces up to 6 months in jail. In the days leading up to the trial, the nation's journalists rallied around Buchanan, a young woman many felt represented the best of their profession. They sought answers, including why Fry, a graduate of the University of Oregon School of Journalism and an Emerald alumnus, ever filed those subpoenas in the first place. Or, as one newspaper pointedly asked, is the law an ass, or is it Lane County District Attorney Bill Fry? It's true, Fry lost the primary election for the 4th District Congressional seat the same day Buchanan's article was published. It's true the Emerald supported Charles Porter, an old friend of mine, over Fry for that seat, citing the DA's questionable blanket endorsement of the Vietnam War effort. It's true Fry made frequent, often vehement, anti-Buchanan public appearances during the case, which moved Buchanan's lawyer to call, if unsuccessfully, for a new trial. What's not so clear is whether a correlation ever existed between Fry's professional ambitions and Buchanan's summons to court. For his part, Fry would deny such allegations until his death in 1988. Through it all, the law stood by him. "I never got caught up in that. It didn't matter," says Judge Levy, who now sits for the 9th Circuit Court of the U.S. Court of Appeals. "All the prosecutor has to be is right. If his motive is to prosecute somebody and enjoy it while they're doing it, it doesn't matter as long as they are right. And if they're wrong, it doesn't matter how reluctant they are. If they're wrong, they're wrong. The June 1966 trial came early in Levy's career. He was just 36. Still, he vividly recalls Buchanan's case. "It went right to the interest of the newspaper reporter," he says. "Here you have a young lady who is a decent person, who is a student of journalism, who doesn't have any baggage of being any kind of villain or self-promoter. What more ideal personality could you have from a political standpoint to advance your cause?" The cause being to get Oregon its own shield law, a goal about which, perhaps not surprisingly, journalists had a lot to say. Publications covering the trial ranged from The Emerald, which still listed Buchanan as managing editor, and ran supportive editorials titled, among other things, "Some Questions for Mr. Fry," to Buchanan's hometown newspaper, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, "Stay with it, Annette," is one of their headlines, to the New York Times. If the district attorney and other law enforcement officials had done their own investigative work completely, they would not have had to coerce a college student to turn unwilling informer. "It is to her credit that she refused to play their childish game," thundered the Times editorial, "Child's Play in Oregon." Support also arrived in more personal forms. "I had similar trouble with other idiotic and ambitious Lane County district attorneys, Dick W. Johnston, Sports Illustrated executive editor and a U of O graduate," wrote Buchanan in a typed letter. "It didn't actually get to court, but I would like to think I would have stood as fast as you." His parting advice, "Hang in there and grind the bastards down. Everybody in the journalistic profession is proud of you." On campus, Buchanan's journalism professor, Warren C. Price, began a letter-writing campaign to rally professionals to her cause. In the Eugene Register Guard, Price wrote of his pride in Buchanan, who unwittingly, quote, "may now have become the one whose undervalued courage will be used to advocate a privilege law." Buchanan's opinion on her new role? She remained cryptic in interviews. Once when asked if she felt like John Peter Zenger, whose 1734 libel case established U.S. press freedom decades before the First Amendment, Buchanan replied simply, "No, I feel like a college co-ed." But she did believe in what she was doing. When Fry asked her whether a journal should have a special privilege, she answered, "Yes, I do." "Why do you think that way?" "Because I feel it is the only way that a free press can operate and do its job in society," she replied. Kept at home by the needs of three younger children, Buchanan's parents didn't arrive in Eugene until the day before the trial. "She wanted us to stay away because she said it would get ugly," says Sheila, Buchanan's now 88-year-old mother. Ugliness had already crept in. Sheila, her husband Paul, and their children were receiving threatening calls from, quote, "an ex-military guy who spat venom about the girl he thought should be a good citizen and turn in those drug dealers," recalls Marion Hoblett, Buchanan's then 17-year-old sister. The menacing calls set the household on edge. "I can remember coming home from school one day and my mother was vacuuming," Hoblett said. "She didn't hear me come in the house and I tapped her on the shoulder and she just about jumped out of her skin." A photo taken of Sheila and Paul while in Eugene shows them fighting their way through a throng of journalists. Sheila in a posh striped jacket, sports sunglasses a la Jackie Kennedy. Paul, a Department of Agriculture economist, wears a freshly ironed suit. The image ran alongside a Register Guard headline, article headlined, "Parents Agree with Annette." If she feels these convictions are worth suffering for, she is ready and we are to go ahead, Sheila said in the piece. "She stands on her own feet," added Paul. It's standing room only in courtroom one on June 27th, where State of Oregon versus Annette Buchanan starts sharply at 10. Defense Attorney Johnson will call 10 witnesses. Most are long-standing West Coast journalists who almost unanimously champion the use of anonymous sources. "It's as much a part of journalism as the typewriter you pound your story out on," testifies Hugh Blanc, the Wenatchee Daily World's managing editor. "The protection of the integrity of news sources is probably the first tenet of a good reporter," adds Stephen Still, managing editor of California's Oakland Tribune. Any reporter who refused to protect confidential sources would likely, Still says, be drummed out of the business. Are you saying that there is a tradition in your profession that a journalist is entitled to defy or resist or refuse to abide by a court order directing that reporter reveal information? Fry asked Kurt Osterman, associate news director of Portland-based KATU-TV. Yes, Osterman replies. Well, where does your opinion come from? Is this your own idea, or is this really the idea of the profession? With me, it has been an inherited belief and inherited tradition. What, Judge Levy interjects, would be the penalties of defying this tradition? Being ostracized from the profession, Osterman said. Still, Fry wants documentation. Do you have some authority for that statement? Fry asks John Holting, dean of the U of O School of Journalism, concerning Holting's opinion that reporters must often grant sources anonymity to unearth news. Would you regard as authority the editors of various newspapers around the country? The dean replies. Well, have you got something in writing? The overcrowded courtroom has been stewing for hours in the early summer heat when Johnson calls his 10th and final witness, District Attorney Fry. The two men, both in the prime of their careers, face one another. In some of the issues of the Oregon Daily Emerald that came out during May of this year, were you criticized in the editorial pages? Asked Johnson. I don't know what you mean by criticize, and I don't read the Oregon Daily Emerald, Fry replies. Cries of surprise fill the courtroom. Fry, like many of the players in this drama, is also a U of O graduate. Cries of surprise fill the courtroom. You do not, exclaims Johnson. I can explain that answer, Fry quickly responds. I am given copies from time to time, but I do not regularly read the Oregon Daily Emerald, and did not during the month of May. I don't want this thing to get out of hand, Judge Levy interjects for the second time that day. Apt words in a trial rife with objections, sustains, and muddled intents. More than once, the court reporter is asked to review the record and clarify what took place just moments before. Then, halfway through questioning, Johnson accidentally dismisses Fry and must ask him to resume the stand. Soon after, Fry summons Buchanan. Objection, calls Johnson. She has already testified once this day. Is it not enough? Overruled. Fry's questioning of Buchanan goes no smoother than it has all month. Johnson argues the impropriety of compelling Buchanan to publicly answer questions she refuses to address privately. Levy sees the point. Questioning stalls. Court recesses to the following morning. Closing arguments begin at 10. Johnson speaks first. It has been suggested by some, and I think incredibly, that why didn't Annette Buchanan somewhere along the line simply say, well, I don't remember the names anymore. That's an easy out, an obvious out, but it would be a false out, and an out that would indeed be contempt of this court, Johnson says. Reporters, he argues, have no licenses, a fact that makes their tradition more binding than anything. As such, Buchanan was simply living up to what she believed to be the canons of her profession. How many times, Johnson continues, do we say when we intend to pass the highest compliment to someone else that his word is his bond? Well, Annette Buchanan's word was her bond. It is simpler than that for Fry. This is a case, I think, involving the law of the land and the dignity of this court. I don't think that any honest contention could be made that this respondent's refusal to abide by the order of the court was not willful. The court, he continues, has been brought into disrespect and dishonor. Perhaps this wasn't Buchanan's intention, but it has happened, and the question remains whether a private group is going to prevail over the law. It is noon when Buchanan rises to hear the verdict. Her face is pale, and she looks to Judge Levy. He asks if she'd like to say anything before the ruling. No, sir, she whispers. The verdict, guilty. The sentence, a maximum $300 fine. Stunned, Buchanan buries her face in her hands, shielding herself from a world she thought she understood, but of which she'd somehow lost control. Now, after weeks of turmoil, anxiety, and unsought attention, she finally finds herself alone, if only for a moment, in solitary darkness. She would pay the fine using money sent from Senator William Noland of California. Noland, editor and publisher of the Oakland Tribune and quasi-celebrity, he had appeared on the cover of Time magazine, was unable to attend the trial but championed Buchanan and sent his managing editor to testify in her support. News of the verdict traveled fast, even making its way across the Atlantic, generating the UK headline, "Girl Who Refused to Tell is Fined 100 Lire by U.S. Court." Hundreds of donations poured in, some 700 supportive letters and telegrams from Europe, Asia, and 32 states. She didn't pay up right away, though. Buchanan and Johnson, by this time fast friends, appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, which upheld the guilty verdict. Next, the pair petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court. "It would have been exciting," Johnson says of the chance to present such a novel question, but the judges passed, and so in 1968, Buchanan's legal efforts ended flatly 2 years after they began. By this time, much else had changed. Buchanan, for one, was no longer Buchanan. In June 1967, she married Mike Conard, a photographer she met during the trial. She had also dropped out of college, perhaps unable to recover from the 11 hours of incomplete grades she took in the spring of 1966. "I wish she could tell the story herself," her mother said in an interview during the summer of 2012, "but she can hardly talk to us." At age 67, Buchanan could no longer walk, dress, or feed herself. Up until 2 Christmases ago, she sang, carols mainly, but she stopped speaking in 2006. Her doctors suspected frontal lobe dementia due to head injuries caused by 2 car collisions and a horseback riding accident. After more than a decade of declining health, Buchanan died on February 1, 2013, this year. The names of her sources died with her. "I don't think she ever anticipated that it was going to be a big issue," says her sister Marion. "She was just writing an article for the college newspaper about kids using drugs. I think it was a shock to everybody." Buchanan's family knows only vaguely the case's role in the development of Oregon's Shield Law. In the wake of the trial, Secretary of State Tom McCall, himself a U of O journalism graduate, said he would push for such a law. It was as governor that McCall signed Senate Bill 206 in April 1973, making it illegal for any authority to compel Oregon media representatives to share their sources and, McCall said, providing, quote, a shield for the public's right to know. Some scholars continue to debate the influence of Buchanan's case. Her own lawyer, who still practices in Eugene, thinks the Shield Law overbroad. Nonetheless, hers was a fresh face that spurred discussion, a compelling story that encouraged action. The media coverage of her trial meant Shield Laws were on the political mind. Just weeks after the Lane County case concluded, President Lyndon B. Johnson told reporters that a citizen should be free to confide in the press without fear of reprisal or being required to reveal or discuss his sources. The revelations in May 2013 of the U.S. Justice Department using a subpoena to obtain Associated Press reporters' phone records suggest that differences of opinion remain with regard to interpreting press freedoms. Buchanan never publicly said how she felt about her article's unexpected importance. She did remain in journalism, but as an Oregonian copy editor rather than as a reporter. "I just did not want to be on the firing line anymore," she told this magazine in 1987. "I didn't want a byline. I wanted to be behind the scenes." When Annette Buchanan was 12 years old, a horse kicked out her teeth. She was riding along the beach with her badly buckled saddle slipped. To avoid falling off completely, Buchanan hung onto the pommel upside down facing the horse's pounding hooves. She would spend the rest of her life wearing a false plate to hide that day's scars. Perhaps it would have been best if she had let go, if she let the runaway leave her. But even at 12, Buchanan's instinct was to hold on for the whole ride. When life turned her literally upside down, unexpected and unwanted, Buchanan chose to face the coming charge. It knocked out her teeth. It changed her whole life. It could have been avoided. Then again, letting go never did come naturally to Annette Buchanan. And this was The Stand She Took, written by Elizabeth Kramer, who first heard of Annette Buchanan as a journalism student at the University of Oregon. She graduated in 2012 and currently works as an assistant editor at Wet Paint Entertainment in Seattle. And this was published in the Oregon Quarterly magazine of the U of O, autumn 2013. And now I'd like to read a poem, a remarkable poem by Juanita Huebner, who used to live here and now is professor of Spanish at the University of Oregon, as well as major organizer of its new employees union. Walking Tour of Astoria by Juanita Huebner. Here, where time is washed by rain, when space is marinated by water, here in a tripled horizon of ribbons, aquatic, terrestrial, aerial, where rivers are confluences of endless fingers feeding the palm of the ocean, the land drunken and emerald, and where the undefined pewter sky seldom dissolves from its neutral mirror into a blaze of blueness, here in days, in nights, in all seasons, in motion, moving with the wind, murmuring its syllables, its paragraphs rhymed into neighborhoods and green-flamed forest, without a map, with only an open wonder, distant, alone, with the mind rolling forever like languages of salmon and sturgeon through these rivers against a backdrop so familiar, so wordlessly known. Burrowing inside the velvet and wax mingled by a single plant, the azaleas burning like red Christmases and conversations of leaves, and going underneath, down toward the precious burdens of seeds, seeds folded by the old hands of the wind into rich, dark earth, mazes of roots, a seed falling through whispered cities of misted trees, pulled by gravity toward a subterranean birth, and below, where privacy is so extreme it loses its shape, where tunnels are long thoughts of unspoken sentences, where questions sink into the subsoil of language, burrowing below, all the misfortunes, the lost belief crushed into the faces of strangers, hearts cocooned like bottled storms, like boxed blackness wishing to ascend, to break ground, and begin to walk. To walk into swallowed hours, the night so enlarged by sound, the endless chorus echoing up the slope, a chorus of seals feasting on sushi within an old wooden amphitheater of houses, cupping sound and water in a haunting music, the music like a soul in a strange aquarium, whirling out like a river of incense, above the disappearing grid of pilings capped with moss, pillars holding up a vanished history, a history of work and resource and politics, harvests of sea and wood by unending mouths of promises and lies, walking, where the more of the dead than the living walk with us, trapped in quicksands of insomnia, the night covering its eyelid over the town with the moon, the stone navel of the sky, pure, patient, old and ivory, a silence passing through the air, through the doors of eyes, and along the smooth, pine-stained strands of light, along arrowing spines of trees, above the great celery girders of the bridge, and straight through the woven logic of a spider's web stretched between a street pole and an early star harnessed to an October sky. Walking, dispossessed of what crowds and collapses the acquisitive world, a world nauseous from the fanfare of technology, of trinkets, of estrangement's profusion of artifacts, walking the trainless tracks, split rock and rusted rail, and toward a burnt horizon of embers, a bum's park covered by wild lilacs and cardboard, a place of stories made fluent by cheap wine and solitude, told to rock-ringed fires, told over and over again, the smoke winding and thinning from a final bed of ash, and again walking, the senses spreading to invent new adjectives for what is beautiful, the senses electric in a dervish of leaves, in a ripe labyrinth of berries, in a crow's dance of ragged wings in a sky salted with stars, the senses spearing the flying fish of gossip and contempt, using their cold, hard bones as comb for the snarls, throwing the rest into a limitless gallery of waves and moons, as circular and redundant as the town's memory, the senses like acid and sugar in a balance, the senses flowing like 20 fingers over the braille geographies of sex and secrets, and walking. The legs carve elusive limbs and twigs into the unanimous fog. Fig, the foot arcs a path from oneself to oneself, receiving horizons and letting them loose. Every image carried for a while like water in two joined hands, seeing, erasing, and each moment moving, pausing, becoming the passage which walks itself. And that was Walking Tour of Astoria by Juanita Huebner. And this has been Michael McCusker. And I read that poem like a fast walk, so I could just make it within this period. But that's the way Juanita wrote it. That's the way she has always done most things. And I will probably see you next week if certain dooms do not occur, like drones incinerating me. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.